Mike?
Mike?
Mine is.
Good afternoon and welcome to the March 15th meeting of the General Plan Advisory Committee. Just for our folks in the back, we have a couple dead mics up here if you guys want to check on them. Including staffs, which is not good because we want to hear what they have
one.
To say. Oh, you got one. Okay. We have a quorum. We are missing Melanie right now. She may or may not come in later. And we will start with a moment of silence. All right, thank you. And moving on to the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, we will start with GPAC announcements. Anybody have? Here.
Just one quick announcement. The Morro Bay Open Space Alliance is holding its annual meeting April 19th at the golf course. Everyone's welcome to come, share some appetizers, get some new information, updates on projects, and have a good time. We're hoping to have some music, some art, and a lot of your friends will be there. Thanks. 5 to 7.
Thank you. Anybody else? No? All right. Moving on to public comment. I don't see that we have any unless, do you have public comment? Or are you just visiting?
No, I'd like to have public
comment. All right. You're just in time. You can come to the podium, give your name. You are.
Okay, so hello. My name's Kristen Hedlund. I've lived here for 28 years, and I understand that today you're going to be speaking about the zoning codes. So I do have some concerns. I live in North Morro Bay, and in North Morro Bay on Main Street, there's a 10-acre parcel. And at the last GPAC meeting, I heard that that property is going to be placed at a density where it can go three stories. I think that this should be reviewed because there's going to be well over 300 residential units, and that probably means 500 cars. I think that there will be a major traffic problem at San Jacinto and Main Street that will impact all the residents of North Morro Bay, the parents driving kids to and from school at Del Mar School. I think that this impact to the residents of Morro Bay for the rest of our life with traffic jams there should be a traffic study and reconsider whether this should be allow three stories. I'm concerned about the height limit that was discussed at the last GPAC meeting about going three stories and possibly the additional 7 feet. And I guess the thought at that meeting was to do down Morro Bay Boulevard and Main Street in the downtown area for a start. And I think that there should be a stepping stone to see if that works out. And if it doesn't, then I don't think the whole town should be allowed to raise the height limit because everywhere you go, people will be building 3- and 4-story homes. And that's not really what Morro Bay is all about. We're kind of a small, quaint town, and I'm not really in favor of living in a place where there's going to be so much traffic. Thank you.
Thanks, Kristen. Did staff want to respond to that?
Sure.
First, to start off, that the item that's on the agenda this evening is for lateral access. Now, to speak to Ms. Hedlund's concerns, the property that she's speaking to is the Chevron property, the 10-acre piece over on North Main. Heights in that area are allowed at 30 feet. We're not proposing to change that, nor are we proposing to change density. The density for that site could have around 200 units, a little over 200 units at it, based on the high density designation that's applied to it. And as far as the height in the downtown, we're not proposing to change heights all over town to the taller 37-foot. It's just along a portion of the corridor on Morro Bay Boulevard and a portion of the corridor that would go out Main Street and probably involve somewhere in the neighborhood of about 70 lots or so. Is that about right, maybe, that could actually accommodate a height at that point? We're not proposing it anyplace else. So hopefully that provides some clarification as to where we're going with that. And it is really to do, as actually Ms. Hedlund indicated, is to sort of see what that would be like. You know, we don't want to apply it everywhere, because I don't know that the city really wants to go three stories everywhere. I don't know that would be appropriate either. That would dramatically probably change the character of the way the city looks and feels. But I think some moderate height increases to allow some mixed-use projects that would be feasible does somewhat make sense. And I think the GPAC thought that, as did the Planning Commission, although the Planning Commission's asked us to return with some additional information.
So. And even with those 70 lots, it would still be going through the process. It would be not just a blanket, okay, everybody can go three stories. Everybody would be coming before a Planning Commission, and it would be reviewed and deemed whether it's appropriate or not.
Yeah, absolutely. Apply with design guidelines that apply to those areas and those types of things for setbacks and articulation and those types of things.
At 600 Main, they already have three stories there, right? Was that a special? And there's, I think, a couple of condo complex maybe adjacent to that on Pacific has
because of how we
limit.
Calculate height. Some of them could be within the height limitation at 30 feet and be three story. Because
property
of
slopes.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. We do the average natural grade thing and underneath the footprint of the building, and so if you have a lot of slope underneath the footprint of the building, then you can kind of get to three stories if that's the case.
So, Scott, is there interest in this 10-acre parcel to develop?
So it was on the market for a little while, and yes, it was being marketed, I think, by Stafford McCarty, who's working with us on the Market Plaza property. And then there was a bunch of interest. I spoke with several different developer-type folks that were interested in putting multifamily housing there. And then when they got into negotiations, they found that they didn't have the clearance, I think, from County Environmental Health for the cleanup that was done there. It wasn't clean to a residential standard. It was clean to an industrial standard. And so there was some question about whether they had the clearance for that portion of it, I believe, but not clearance to the residential standard that would allow houses to go on there. But the indication was that they did clean it to that. They just didn't have the clearance for that. And so I believe they're going through that process. At least that's based on the last conversation that I had with them.
Is there a traffic study or some other thing that they would have to do?
Absolutely.
Okay.
that's one of the first things they'd have to do is, you know, how are you coming in and out of the site? What are your trips generated? What are those due to the intersections that would be affected? Those types of things would absolutely be required as part of the CEQA review, the environmental review for the project. So, yeah.
Is our circulation element in the upcoming plan will speak to all that? It'll be.
It does look at intersection function, based on our land use map that we have a draft land use map that you all reviewed, and it's based on the land use intensities that are in there, and that's what they ran the circulation element, the traffic model on. So yeah.
So the Highway 1 and Main Street assumed that there was that additional traffic as well.
It pushes the traffic out from all the densities that are allowed in those areas. It pushes those, like, at the maximums almost, you know, pushes them out to the intersections. It shows what that would do over time. Because that's part of our planning process to tell us, hey, you need to start looking at this intersection, and maybe you need to start, you know, providing assessments to development in this area so you can get the improvements like the traffic circle that we need at Highway 41 and Main. So,
the EIR will also look at that in more detail as well.
If anything's possible. Are there issues? We have a housing element that identifies that, you know, based on our density and then builds it out to that amount. So we're not supposed to downzone property that has that in it. So that becomes a problem from a land use standpoint, based on how current state law is written. So yes, somebody could purchase it and not do anything with it, and then it would remain undeveloped. But short of that, if someone were to come forward, you know, we would have a hard time internally making that change to it. Like, oh, no, we don't like it at R4 now. We want to downzone it to something else. State law sort of prohibits us from doing that.
Refresh my memory under the proposed zones that we're going to have in the plan. Where will they fall under what category? Will it still be R4?
Or no,
it's changing to high density, right?
That's what,
what we're calling.
Yeah, HD,
so it's the zoning now will sound almost the same as the land use.
As the land use,
It'll be similar, and it'll be similar.
So it'll both be HD.
Yeah.
But it doesn't allow any change really.
We're not proposing
any change.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
It's really just reflective of more current zoning practices. Is why the name's changing.
I wanted to put out an idea. Sharon O'Leary, who works with our Community Resources Connections office with the city, came in and was chatting with me about something called safe parking. And at first I thought, oh, this must mean being safe when you're walking to your car, but it does not. It has to do with people whose only home is their car, having a safe place to park that vehicle without risk of being ticketed. And it was an interesting concept. She has already had meetings with our chief of police and faith-based community to talk about safe places for people to park. She wanted to get together and meet perhaps with the business community. And I do think it will be an issue that relates to the general community as well, because most of our churches and places of worship are in communities. We don't, you know, they're right in the middle of towns. But it was an interesting concept. It included a lot of oversight. They were doing case management with it. It included health and safety issues, sanitation stuff, supervision, places for trash, bathrooms, access to showers, all of that. And of course, the vehicles needed to be registered, licensed, insured. So I don't know, and as she pointed out, there's conflicting ordinances because you can't park and sleep in your car. You can't even take a nap in your car, which kind of scary. But I wondered if that might be something as we move forward to address, if it's a general plan thing or if it comes under something else. You know, it sort of seemed like a land use thing in terms of where could we provide places for that aren't campgrounds, you know, that sort of thing. And I did print out San Luis Obispo has a safe parking ordinance, and you're welcome to take this, even though you can find it online. So, you know, I thought I'd throw it out there as part of kind of the public comment time. It's not something we can really discuss right now, but whether we might want to think about that down the road.
I will touch base maybe next week when we have our department head meeting with the police chief. And I know he's been having those conversations. He's alluded to that in the past, and I'll ask him where, you know, what those conversations have developed to and that type of thing. So at least I'll check in on that part of it moving forward.
Yeah, one thing she was pointing out was that people get ticketed. The tickets are usually dismissed because there is no real set policy that's not contradictory. So the cost of the policing may be excessive in terms of what can be recovered and why. You know, and the idea of keeping, she was telling me she had 15 people that they had found safe parking situations for. So that's 15 people who aren't sleeping in the parks or in other sort of places where they could be at risk or other people could be at risk. So it seemed like a good idea.
I don't remember any of this in the general plan, but someone, maybe a homeless task force in the county or whatever, would have projections for the next 30, 40 years on the homeless population increases?
I'm not familiar with projections. We do have that information in the housing element. It's pretty outdated now.
Mm-hmm.
But the current numbers come out, I believe, every 2 years for all the jurisdictions in the county.
Do we do an annual homeless count here? We did that in Escondido.
I think it's every 2 years.
I think we've been dovetailing with the work that's done in the county, my recollection. I'm a little fuzzy on this, I'll be honest, because I'm not involved with it, but that sounds about right.
Sharon was suggesting to me that the numbers are down, actually, that they have found placements, homes, situations, so that sounds like a lot of the programs they're instituting are working to get people the help that they need. So
I know they spiked during the recession as well, generally, all over.
I've heard good results that our new police chief has been working really closely with the homeless to try to get that resolved. So sounds like that's working.
Yeah, it's one of the initiatives that they're focusing on.
I would just say probably that idea wouldn't necessarily rise to the general plan level. And if it did, it would probably be in the housing element, which we're not updating right now. But possibly there would be some overlap with zoning and other things like police, like Scott said.
Yeah, we will be updating after we finish this process. We'll be going into cycle 6, right, of the housing element update. So we're picking back up with that, and
Never a dull moment.
Yeah, exactly.
that's going to start in 2019 is the latest from SLOCOG on that. So.
Yeah. Right around the corner. So consent calendar, we have nothing. Unfinished business, we have nothing. So we'll go right into Michael Baker's PowerPoint presentation.
Okay. Great. Hi, everybody. So we're back with more on lateral access tonight, and I'll go quickly through our status update. So as we've been talking about for a while, we have our public draft of Plan Morro Bay coming up soon. We did submit it to the Coastal Commission staff for their initial review at the end of January, and we have received some review back from them in the last couple weeks. So we're taking a look at that and hope to discuss it with them very soon. And then after that, we will prepare the public draft. The zoning code is that three of the modules have been presented to you and to the Planning Commission, and there are two more, I understand.
There's four, and you've seen two. We're on module three. It will be the one that's coming to you next.
Oh, okay, sorry. Yeah. That's right. Two of them have come to you. The third has been sent to the staff and us.
It's under staff review right now. Yeah.
I thought Martha said there were two more.
Anyway, I thought there was five, too, and I asked her the question the other day, and she said there was four. So
okay.
I'm going to go, okay,
we're making
four.
Progress through the zoning code draft, but we're not all the way there yet. So the next one that you will see will have the allowed uses in it. So that's a big piece.
It'll also a vacation rental will be one of the things that are in there. Yeah. So.
And then Rincon is leading the draft of the environmental impact report, and that is still being worked on.
Go ahead.
No. Before we go any further, Amy, could you give us just a brief summary of the comments from Coastal? That I'm just curious if some of their comments are kind of in line with some of the comments we've had, concerns?
Well, I should say that the comments from Coastal are focused on the coastal issues and the Coastal Act. So there are some elements they didn't even comment on because they're not coastal issues. For example, noise and community well-being, and I think there were a couple others. I don't know how I want to frame this. We still need to have a conversation with them about their comments, and there's one major section that they didn't comment on, so we are hoping they will. So there are some pretty straightforward comments or comments on specific things that definitely would be similar to things that we've heard from you and other community members and decision-making bodies already. But it's hard to generalize about all of it, I guess.
Yeah, and what was she referring to? And I'm just going to put it out there because why not? So there's an implementation piece that we sent to them, and they didn't comment on it, and they just kind of commented throughout the rest of the other portions of the document about where's the implementation piece.
So they didn't understand
that
was where it was.
And my guess is they're reviewing lots of these things right now, and they're short-staffed. And so it's probably you pick it up, put it down, pick it up, put it down, pick it up, put it down, and all you're doing is focusing on this, the piece that's in front of you, and not really the whole thing as it works together, is my guess, is why that happened, based on conversations I've had with their staff. And so that's probably what we're going to get back. We did send them an email yesterday requesting, hey, we noticed this. You want to take another look at it? And then, we did put that back to them. And so hopefully, you know, they'll take a look at that, and then we'll be able to have a real conversation about everything moving forward, because sort of missed the point a little bit there. So
I think that segues a little bit into the question I have. It's just a big picture question. Given all this back and forth and all there is yet to do, do you have a ballpark for when we could say we now have a local coastal plan in place? I know it's a tough question.
Well, I will give a first response to that, okay, because Michael Baker worked on the plan for Hermosa Beach, which mm-hmm. was adopted by the city last October, and I checked in with the city because I had a question from someone I was working with about where is that one in the process, and Coastal has been reviewing it for 6 months, and they expect it to take another year before it's certified.
So it could be three more years even before it's
I don't know if that's typical, but that's what's going on with a recent
Scott, adoption. You're thinking.
That doesn't surprise me. We have probably been a little more engaged than some other. I mean, we've met with them 5 times now. I'm hoping that lends itself to a shorter process because there's no surprises. We had about probably 85% baked draft of the document, because it didn't have the other. And then we sent them the other pieces lateral access, affordable accommodations, sea level rise, right? And they haven't responded back to those to us yet. And so once we get the information back on those, then those will be put back into the document, and we'll have, you know, pretty much a whole entirely baked document. So hopefully once we get all that information back, we'll have a better idea about where we stand with them. Those are sort of big concepts for them that they haven't responded back to us on yet. And hopefully they give us good comments, and so that we end up where they want us to be. So the timeline is only 6 months, not the year and 6 months that Amy referred to.
Thank you.
But it probably is going to be more like a year.
So there was some public comment, written comment, I believe, that I think went to council, concerned that parts of the document had gone to Coastal and, hadn't it been vetted to the public. And you know, my feeling is each step of the way we're vetting it to the public with every meeting we have, and that things tend to come here. They go to Planning Commission, they go to City Council, and around multiple times. And you know, I think either I can say it or you can say it, but I think the idea is to make sure we're on the right track. This is not the final document. It's just a document going there to say, you know, are we approved on this path? And if things are drastically not going to be approved, that we can make those changes, but there will still be documents that are going to go to council, to us, to Planning Commission for review, and for the general public to look at. Is that?
I understand why the concern was voiced, mm-hmm. and yes, there's if you listen to that comment, you think, well, yeah, why wouldn't we be the ones that review it first? Well, we got to remember that almost half of this project is grant funded. Mm-hmm. And it's related to updating our LCP. And so it's a very important part that they weigh in, and we have it the way that they want to see it. Because if we take it and roll it out before, and then we get all this comment from everybody, and then we send it to Coastal, and they're like, nope, then you have to review it again. That's not time well spent.
Right.
They're going to have a lot to say with what it looks like. They're paying, they're ponying up half the money. And it is, you know, and to update our LCP portion of this, right? And so my experience, and I'm sure Amy's, is they often have a lot to say about the policies when you send them to them. I've worked through when I was in Pismo updating general plan LCP portions of it, doing it kind of section by section, and they always had lots to say about it. Even when we were just trying to get rid of the pieces that we'd done, we said, hey, we want to say check that one off the box, that box off, and get it out of there and move on down the road to streamline the document. Even then, they always had lots to say. So we know that, and we know that they can make substantial changes to the direction and the way the document looks, and that's why we didn't want to, here's the city's public draft, and then somebody's not paying attention, and then we go through this process with GPAC, with Planning Commission, with City Council, send it off to Coastal then, and then we're doing a whole rewrite of it, and mm-hmm. then you have to look at a whole new document when it comes back. Just didn't seem to make a lot of sense.
Okay.
Based on our experience.
Yeah, made sense to me how it's going.
Yeah, and it's still officially the administrative draft, even though
right.
this is the first time Coastal is looking at it. It is not their official review.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So tonight we are going to take the next step regarding the lateral access task. And that's going to include a revised version of the poster that you saw in January and a memo, which I'm sure you've all seen somewhat in your packet. So I'm going to do a relatively short presentation to try to give you an overview and to give the folks at home some kind of key points of where to look for different things in the memo, because it is pretty large. And then we will take a good chunk of time to discuss. That would be great, yeah. So just to, I think we talked about this last time, but to go a little more into the details of what is lateral access. So this is something that the Coastal Commission is very concerned with. It is a Coastal Act issue. And the Morro Bay Zoning Code does define lateral access, so that's here on the screen. And the Coastal Commission also has a definition. It's a little more broad. So we actually talk about the shoreline and coastal bluffs, because that is the type of topography that we have here. Not every community does. So to remind us what the task is, this is one of the things that Scott was just referring to that we are doing for the most recent grant, where we got additional funding from the Coastal Commission to study certain issues in more detail. So we're analyzing pedestrian access along the shoreline, and we're focusing on an area that is less accessible generally than the rest of the shoreline, which is the other parts of the shoreline are generally less developed. So here's our focus area, basically from the Morro Bay Oyster Company down to the 456 Embarcadero Suites. And then out of this analysis, the idea is that we would have a more, to have a definite understanding of how lateral access is regulated in the city and what type of design is looked for, and to include policies and implementation in Plan Morro Bay. So starting out with the memo, we've got several sections in there. Like I said, it's pretty large, so we can get into more detail during the question and answer. But we did identify some key issues related to lateral access. Those are environmental, design related, the physical connectivity of access, how the access works with the leaseholder system, natural hazards, for example, sea level rise, and there's several in there. And then what the policies are now, and looking at other policies and revisions to those policies moving forward. So the existing conditions section is, I think, the biggest section of the memo. And we have the existing legal framework. So we have federal, state, and local regulations that relate to lateral access. And we also show figures 3A through 3C. That's the existing lease site information. The lease sites are where the lateral access requirements come into play in terms of when the city is working with the property owner to improve or to renegotiate a lease.
So that's why we're focusing on those. The physical conditions include the existing connections. So one example of that is the Harbor Walk that is connecting a good chunk of the northern end of the focus area. Figures 4A through 4D show the existing conditions, whether there are gaps in access and then other types of access that exist, including Harbor Walk, including Bayside, what we're calling Bayside and street side access. So generally the street side access is going to be the sidewalk or the Harbor Walk, and the Bayside is a combination of things that we did talk about last time and we'll get into more. Next up in the physical condition section is the gaps in lateral access. So this is something that we've focused on quite a bit. It's something that the poster addresses somewhat, but it's addressed in much more detail in the memo. Table 1 and figures 5A through 5C identify gaps. And one thing to note that table 1 has quite a few gaps listed. Seven of the things listed, of the places listed in that table, have improvements pending. So either they are up for their leases are expiring this year, or they are making improvements because they want to. And so that's noted in the table. That's one of the positives. I'm giving away one of my later slides. But one of the things that we've noted that will improve lateral access even without this plan in place. So there are generally four types of gaps that are discussed in Table 1, and those are where Bayside lateral access doesn't exist at all, and one example of that is Off the Hook, which is going to be improved soon. And I'm not trying to single out any particular locations, just wanted to kind of give you something to visualize. There are quite a few other examples of that. And the second category would be where Bayside lateral access exists but is unimproved or is not accessible at all times. And as we discussed last time, there's a lot of different reasons for that, and some of them we don't think, not everyone thinks, should change necessarily because of safety reasons, for example. So one example of that is the Morro Bay Yacht Club. The third category is where street side, so on the Embarcadero side, lateral access exists but is unimproved. And the main example of this is the street ends, where streets intersect with Embarcadero. There is a pedestrian crossing there, but it is not marked very well currently. And then the final category would be where Bayside lateral access exists, but there are semi-permanent features that make it unclear, or to the person who's not familiar, they may not realize that there is pedestrian access there, or it may even be difficult for someone who isn't as mobile. And one example of that would be the tables and windscreens at Blue Sky Bistro. The rest of the sections in the physical conditions include encroachments. So that's where there are property line encroachments, and that doesn't always involve the pedestrian access, but it's just something to note that it could be worked out as we move forward with further lateral access in the future. Signage and wayfinding, so this is another thing I think we discussed quite a bit at the last meeting, where there might be too many signs, so it's confusing. There might not be enough signage related to lateral access. The signage might not be the right size. And then other issues we go into a lot of detail on in the memo. And then finally, public safety, which wasn't seen as a huge issue looking at the existing conditions, but we did take a look at lighting, crime, traffic, and accessibility for those with disabilities. The last section on this slide is the projected physical conditions, and this is more natural environment related, looking at sea level rise, ESHA, seismic issues, and tsunami, and how that might relate to lateral access moving forward. So the findings were summarized both for opportunities and constraints. As I mentioned, one of the opportunities is that there are lease renewals and other improvements underway already. So a good percent of where we've identified gaps of those locations are already scheduled to be improved. There are also recent good examples of design and materials on projects that have added lateral access or improved their lateral access. There is an increased population of eelgrass in the harbor, so I haven't talked about it so far tonight, but in the memo we talk about how eelgrass can sometimes, there is a bit of a issue between protecting eelgrass and increasing lateral access. So there are ways to build the lateral access that have fewer impacts on the eelgrass, but also generally the eelgrass efforts in terms of restoration have been more successful recently. And then there are other examples where ADA accessibility along the waterfront has been improved, and that's an ongoing goal with the lateral access requirements. Some of the constraints are the existing wide diversity of materials and design, and that sometimes leads to issues with connecting the lateral access, and also just the leading, again, a person who is unfamiliar to where the lateral access actually is. There is ongoing environmental protection happening for the eelgrass, so we do have to be mindful of that with the regulations for lateral access. And then there are some traffic challenges for pedestrians and cyclists on the street side. So taking a look at ways that that might be able to be improved kind of in tandem with lateral access implementation. There is a section after this on design, and this is where we actually have some recommended materials and looks for the four things here. So materials includes things like railings and decking. Signage and wayfinding includes, the signs that are actually compliant with what the Coastal Commission requires, and also includes other types of signage and wayfinding that might be an added help for those who are looking for this. One example of that is directory signs. This is a recommendation in there. We talk about lighting. We have a recommendation for how intense lighting should be along the access way. One thing I think we discussed last time is that this could serve as the pedestrian access for the California Coastal Trail, and that is something that is accessible 24 hours a day. So having some lighting that could assist those who are there at night, both for that reason or just because they want to be out on the bay at night, but making it, but thinking also about what the impacts are of that lighting. And also, this is furnishings and amenities is something that I think is already great in a lot of places along your lateral access, but just making sure that continues. And that would include things like benches and planters and interpretive signs, public bathrooms. So we'll definitely talk a lot more about the memo, but I wanted to let you know some of the changes we've made to the poster based on your feedback and feedback from the city staff. You have it in your packet, and it's here in front of you. This is the spot that works for the cameras, so I apologize to the folks who are down on the end. We did add the rest of the places labeled as C, which is the bayside access that is being improved in the near term. We had left those off last time, and we also added labels that tell you a little bit more about where certain locations are rather than just the addresses. There are some other edits to the text, but those are the big edits. So this poster does show the preferred alignment, so it doesn't show the gaps. It just shows one line that shows the street side and bayside. And then it also shows in the letters on the far right both common types of gaps that we've identified as well as some recommended solutions. So the poster really represents some of the big themes that are in the memo, but the memo is where the detail is. So that is an overview of all of this material, and I'd love to hear your thoughts, questions.
I had a couple of questions about a couple of sites. I bring up the Yacht Club again. I notice it says here that there's sometimes there are activities there that could be safety issues. But it seems like the gate that's there, at least every time I walk by there a lot, it seems like every time you go by there, it's always closed. So there is, even though there may be sometimes periodically some activities that might be safety related, is there some reason why the access is closed off 100% of the time to non-members? Do we know that?
I think Scott may have more information than I do, but
I'm not sure.
For the city.
Yeah, I'm not sure that their permit requires it to be open. I don't know that 100% for sure, because I haven't looked at it recently. We've had some conversations with them, and sort of offhandedly, some of the members have referred to that being the case. Internally, I haven't done the research. We need to look into it.
Okay. Yeah, I was just curious about that. It may not be directly related to access, but there's some of the sites have been discussed at some point for things like a convention center, and I'm just wondering what is the current status of that. I thought there was something like at the foot of Pacific, maybe around the Libertine, that they were talking about that at one point, or I may have this totally wrong, but I was just curious to know, is there any current plan for anything like that anywhere around here?
Say that again?
A convention center of some kind, or a meeting center, or something? I know, people roll their eyes when you ask, but I hadn't heard anything recently, and I didn't know if anything was in the works.
It was a previous plan that had come through the process and was denied in that location.
It was in that location,
yeah, between that and the Roses Landing there and in that area there, and it came through and was not approved. Involved, I think, Doug Redican, who owns the lease on Roses Landing, and Burke Caldwell, who has the lease on the Libertine.
Okay.
Correct. They were joint applicants.
Yeah, I thought so. Okay. Yeah. But that just fell through?
Yeah,
Okay.
I've known Doug. I've known for a long time because he's a restaurant in Pismo. And Bert, I've run into. I've known him quite a few years too. And they had sent me pictures of what it looked like and some of the draft plans.
Something in the Tribune at some point about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So it wasn't just it never made it through the process.
Okay. And then I just had one other question, and then I'll let other people talk. But reading through some of the questions about access where there's fishing operations, and clearly you don't want something to interfere with that. But, again, it seems like those are things that are used sort of intermittently, some of them more frequently than others, but for fishing operations. But sometimes they're not. And I'm just wondering, you know, it seems like some of the sort of backyards of some of the buildings and some of those places, maybe if they're not actively being used, maybe they could be opened up at other times for access. So I don't know if that's under consideration, but it seems like, again, I understand that while things are actually happening, you don't want, you know, you've got big things of fish going around and machinery and things, and you don't want people right there, but maybe the rest of the time it would be nice to have those available if that's possible.
Yeah, we have some of the projects are conditioned that way. About a year and a half ago, we, you know, had to work with Giovanni's to open theirs back up. They had it closed kind of permanently.
Yeah.
And their condition required it to be open. We went and talked to Gio, and he was like, okay, I'll delineate it for you. And he goes, but we can have it. And theirs was approved to have the sign up that they can close it down. You can walk on the sidewalk around the inside of it when they're, you know, unloading whatever they're unloading. And they're pretty decent about, you know, opening it back up when they're not using it. So that would be the model. I mean, that's kind of one of the examples that they're offloading fish there quite a bit. And so you really don't want people walking around when forklifts are pulling stuff
up. Oh, yeah. And some of it might require some cleanup or, you know, stacking things in the corner so that you could walk through it or whatever. You know, there's different places that have different conditions. But it just seems like they're used really intermittently for these other things, and yet they seem to be not really available at all. So maybe there's some in-between kind of thing that could be used.
Is it okay to start talking about the lease sites? I mean, is this the right time?
I think we're taking all comments.
Okay, yeah. Good. Then it seems to me, I was surprised when I read through the table at how many leases are either terminating now or in the near future and are under discussion. I know that the council has been looking at some of them. And your comment about diversity in design made me, and several other things, made me wonder, are we in any way able to coordinate those projects so that the access, the lateral access, is convenient and useful. We tend to look at these one at a time, and the person who's owning that lease wants to do, they want to comply at the least possible cost. But that may not always be the best way for us to solve the access problem. So is there a mechanism now in place for us to coordinate those things?
Why we're doing the plan.
Well, I know, but the problem there is timing, because you know they're moving faster than we're going to have this ready to go, it seems to me.
Yeah, it's okay. But having a lot this information available to lead into that planning process is fantastic, because one of the issues you see, and it's called out in this document, is the various iterations of ways people have implemented the public access. Even they have it, but it's, you know, it's disjointed. It doesn't connect directly. You go from material to material to material, so it doesn't look like it's public access. Right. This will help us get away from that. And internally, I mean, since I've gotten here, I mean, that's one of the things I've recognized as being an issue. And so we, as applications come forward, and Harbor's been pulled into this as well, so I work with Eric on this, as where Eric Endersby, the Harbor Director. And we want to make sure when those things come through consent of landowner that those folks are saying, hey, look, our expectation is you're going to have consistent lateral access. So that's the conversation we've had with the folks that are going to be, that are processing off the hook, so that they can connect seamlessly to the lease sites adjacent to theirs. And then off the hook, Libertine's going to be coming up at the same time, and so they're going to have to match their lateral accesses. Those two properties and the way they're the way they'll probably come forward, Libertine hasn't come forward yet, but I've seen draft plans, will stick out a little bit further toward the ocean side of those lease sites. And so they'll be able to connect and then bring that connection back around to the street end that's there. And so those are conversations that we've had with the folks that have consent of landowner on off the hook, and conversations we've had with Bert Caldwell, who has a Libertine lease, saying, well, that's our expectation. We expect you to work together to make that happen.
Okay.
Yes.
That's a good case in point, because I believe that those two together would create the possibility for a loop to go all the way around, from street all the way around to another place. And that's a useful kind of connection to have.
It's fantastic, actually. Yeah. I mean, we're excited about having those things come forward now and having that happen, because some of these leases are well off into the future. These are a couple of what are the leftover Pipkin leases that have been around for a long time, and they're expiring now, along with some of the other ones that are coming up now too. So,
seems like having a list of almost pre-approved materials, railing, width of the path, height of the railing. I walked back along there this afternoon, and it's looking really good. The new, you can tell what's new, and there is a lot of consistency in the new materials. You can see the protection for the eelgrass with the metal slatting, and then some of it runs into more decking and some into brick. But then a lot of the restaurants and all have made an effort to post signs that say, this is public access, you don't have to buy anything. So there was some consistency there. But it makes sense to me that if, when people are coming forward with their proposals, if you say, gee, you know, if you use these materials, this color, this width, this height, that part's going to get approved faster because it's already sort of pre-approved. Yeah. Makes a whole lot of sense.
If we're certainly, well, again, one of the reasons why we're doing this is to make that happen,
right,
because it's been done inconsistently. And we have been, to Glenn's comment, we have been doing that more often. In fact, we have, I kind of forgot about it, but House of Juju is going back to an ethics council meeting on the 27th, mm-hmm. and the council continued that, specifically to say, hey, if you walk between those two, there's a little ramp that goes between that and south, right? It goes between the House of Juju and the adjacent site to the south. And the council said, hey, we want that fixed. Said, you can get rid of some of the improvements you're making to the park over here, Anchor Park, or whatever. You don't need to do those, but we want you to make that connection. And so they're actually getting rid of even the surface material they're changing out from the wood planks that are there that were actually in fairly good shape. Mm. And they're going to make it the metal or fiberglass.
The metal or fiberglass, so it so it'll match that to the adjacent to the south. So you'll have consistency. It'll look much nicer, and it'll look like we were doing something like this and had a planning process and something for them to point to. So that's an example of you know, people paying attention, being the council in this instance, paying attention to that and requesting that change.
Well, and I think also that the buildings having a different look
can be great if there's consistency in some part of that. So, you know, if the walks kind of look the same as they go through and the buildings are all eclectic and different and unique, that's fabulous.
Easier to navigate.
The other thing I was wondering, who's responsible for replacing signs like that one that was, I think you had a photo of that was, I saw it, was really bad. I mean, is that city? Is that a leaseholder? Is that, I mean, there's some of them are state signs, so does the state provide them for
it's
you?
It's the leaseholders are required to. So a couple things moving forward. You know, I mean, everybody's been paying attention to a lot of this, council as well, and so they've given direction that we go through a process where we evaluate the lease sites on, I think, on a five-year rotating basis or what have you. And that one of the things we evaluate as part of that is the compliance with their conditional use permits and coastal development permits. And they're required to maintain the signage and, you know, and to make sure they're compliant with their sign program. Our new sign ordinance that's in draft format right now does the same thing. It says, hey, if one of these things come forward, we're supposed to go and look at the whole sign program for that lease site to make sure that it's compliant, because one of the biggest things that is out of compliance down there is the signage for these buildings, because it just sort of grows and grows and grows over time, and you get a lot of funky signs that are handmade that no one can read. People think it's great. I got all these signs. This is great, but you can't read them, and it just becomes background noise because there's so many of them. So,
a couple of things. Who is responsible when we're talking about improving the surfaces, et cetera? For the little parks, I imagine it's the city, the little pop-out parks that we have. We have a couple of those.
I believe the city maintains all of those.
We walk that just about every day. There's a couple of them that have significant termite damage in those railings and on the benches as you sit and you look down. And I just being a builder, I kind of, my eye goes right to that and go, oh, termite damage. Is there anything that you know lined up in the work program to help us keep up with the things that we're making other people do?
I'm not specifically aware of how they evaluate all of the park spaces and all the facilities within them, Public Works being the responsible department for that. Obviously, they're running around doing maintenance all over town. I don't know how often they go park by park and review them or not. I'd have to inquire about that.
Yeah, and the back to the signs, Amy. I guess the question is, can we, two things, can we require, or would it be conflict with the coastal language, but can we, where we have, using, let's say Geo's, for example, and he has been very, he's worked with us easy, but can there be a sign that says access closed during these hours or access may be limited, just so people know when they get to the sign before they get into it and go, oh, we have to turn around now and find our way out. We all know how that works, but
that's a good example, but he normally, like on the north side of that, they have the gate they close, and it says, it has something to the effect that it's temporarily closed or what have you. And then he has a portable sign that he uses on the south side. Okay. Maybe he doesn't use it all the time. I mean, you walk down there more than I do.
Yeah,
so.
I'm just saying I'd like to see him refreshed and be maybe built into the new signage that we put in there. So that, you know, no, I'm not saying that Gio's doing anything wrong. He's doing a great job. Just kind of maybe fold it in with that one sign so people can see it all.
So normally that's part of the, in Geo's is no different, is part of the sign package that they have to submit as part of their precise plan approval that goes through the city. The sign packages they're required to submit are very detailed because a lot of them relate to public access, and so the Coastal Commission has to review them and okay them, and then we verify that they get installed correctly and that type of thing. But they need to be maintained, and that's part of the conditioning. So if they do have signs that aren't in good maintenance, like some of the examples that were shown in here, we should be going through and making them, you know, bring those up to standard and fix them.
Good. I have two quick things if I could finish. And one would be, I guess, directed to you and your oversight from your building. I think to me it was a hiccup, that issue behind Juju's. We watched that as that was being built. And it was identified right up front. They had to do a temporary little ramp, and I had a conversation with the builder, and then I heard them talking with the architect about somebody blew that, and they were kind of passing the buck on it, which is typical. But
I have no idea why that happened.
Yeah.
So I don't know, and it shouldn't have. It should have matched.
Right.
So why it was allowed to, you know, yeah, be the way that it is, I don't know.
So we're kind of we're paying attention to that for the 2018 ones that are coming up with those gaps that's going to be there.
We're paying attention to those things for all development that's happening right now because that's an issue.
Thank
when you.
When
you see stuff like that, you're like, why would that be allowed to persist? And I don't know the answer to it. I mean, that's a pretty easy, like, hey, that's not correct.
Yeah. No, and I'm not trying to bash anybody. I'm just. And then lastly, this one's for you too, Scott. Is there some way that, of course, if, you know, everyone thinks that all parts of the city needs code enforcement attention first. But it would seem to me that with, like, you know, monitoring the lease sites and the amount of traffic and the amount of money that's spent on the Embarcadero, that we would maybe fold in a little bit more attention by the code enforcement to look at some of these things as a, you know, on a more regular basis. And then also, and maybe you already do this. I've been watching the discussion that they had about how often they would review, like a third of them, I think, at every 5 years, something like that. But can they be put in a directive that before that person comes up again for a lease renewal, they've been inspected by our people? Robert Teff had brought that up when it was talking about the one with the boatyard, and he said there's some issues that have never been fixed yet, and why are we considering a CUP? And I think, to me, that's logical. I mean, how can you get a CUP or an extension when you haven't done what you said you were going to do in the first place? I would like to see that a better job of that.
I wanted to respond to one of your earlier comments,
go
but
ahead.
Did you want to respond to that?
Go ahead.
In terms of the explaining more on the signs, on page 56 is where we have a couple examples of the directory sign, and that recommendation is in there to allow for more interpretation either on that type of sign or even just on the type of interpretive sign that you have now, where you might not be able to have, you know, explanation on every sign that's like at Geos, but if there was some greater storytelling about why we have the lateral access and why it isn't as great of an option in certain places because there are working waterfront uses happening,
sure.
That's part of the story of Morro Bay, and so I like the idea of having those bigger signs where we can actually tell the story more.
Yeah, so. And I meant to comment on page 56, those wayfinding icons in the pavement. Those are hot. I really enjoy those.
Cool.
Those are nice.
I think they're proposed.
That's an idea.
That's a sample.
In the sample, I thought she thought they were kind of hard to see,
but it's cool.
Yeah, but yeah.
Some of the signs are brown and white, some are blue and white. Is that just random?
The versions of the sign, the brown and white ones are the old ones that Coastal required, and the blue and white ones are the new ones.
Because the blue and white definitely stands out better.
Yeah.
A recommendation I would have, just from having traveled a little bit in historic places and small towns and all, I think we need to give it all a name, because just calling it Coastal Access, you know, in some ways, if I were, I don't know, coming from the Midwest that doesn't even have a beach, you know, it's like, well, this is kind of a walkway over the water, but that's not really coastal access. I can't touch it, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I know it's a required coastal commission. You have to have this access. But if we had those blue and white coastal access signs and above it, it was Morro Bay Harbor Walk, so that everywhere along the path that you went from the rock back on in through the Embarcadero, you knew you were on the Morro Bay Harbor Walk. So the whole thing becomes the walk. It's kind of like the Boston Freedom Trail. Mm-hmm. The whole thing is the free. It gets you all through the city. Yeah. So that might be our own little addition if Coastal approves to their signage, but it gives, again, that continuity and a meaning to what we're doing. We're saying, because, you know, just that sign that says you can have access and it's okay, even though we have a restaurant here, You're still a little bit squirrely about walking back there, but if it's part of the Morro Bay Harbor Walk, boom, you're there.
And we term it the Harbor Walk as you get north of Beach Street.
So right. So I would just continue that on south, and that's the name of it, or whatever
the walkway you come that up goes with. North of Beach Street that goes out to the rock is the Harbor Walk. That's what it's called. It has a couple of gaps in it, but that's what it's called. So it, certainly it could be something that we could brand it as and put on signage.
Because it's all still the harbor back there, right? I mean,
it is.
Yeah. So that would be a suggestion I would have moving forward just for the city.
I think that's a very good idea, the branding of it, considering how much time and attention and money has been devoted to this and will be there. Extending the access, we should take advantage of it and brand it with something that will definitely benefit the city. And, you know, I'd also like to say, with respect to the consistency of the access, you know, from the Planning Commission meetings, I've talked about what I call this holistic approach, and that's certainly valid with respect to the width of the access and sort of minimal or maximum heights and railings. But you know, but I'm mindful of Commissioner Lucas's words from time to time about the charm of Morro Bay is its very eclectic nature. So I would be very careful about the notion of consistency in the access, the lateral access. My personal opinion is that consistency is a much overrated virtue. So you know, a set of design choices. But, you know, we do not want this to look like it's been planned by, for lack of a better word, a Disney park designer. We don't want it to look like Fisherman's Village in Los Angeles. And that very consistency or over-design will really take some of the charm away from it, I think.
Well, I'd like to add my vote for Susan's idea also. But I would like to add that it seems to me that the area through Measure D territory would be a big opportunity and a good place to start working on some of this stuff. Because when you walk along from either end of the Harbor Walk there, you feel like you're coming off of a walk and into this free-for-all. And you're mixing with cars and traffic and I know that there are some issues in the parking and so forth, but I would make it a priority if it were up to me to try to get that. It seems like a low-hanging fruit, you know, an easy place to get started.
Right. Don't disagree.
You know, that was sort of similar to what I was talking about, where you have uses that are fishing uses, but, you know, that's all part of you're walking through parking lots and a bunch of other stuff there, but maybe some of that access could be provided along close to the fishing areas, but it wouldn't impede those activities.
Yeah, we've
away
talked
from
about
the cars.
Yeah, we've talked about, you know, like say on the water side of the Coast Guard and the Harbor Department building, you know, you probably don't want to have it out over the water there because you have active fishing things happening there a good majority of the time, and there's a lot of equipment that's sitting there, so probably kind of difficult to put the location there. But bringing it in close to the buildings and running it in front, because people love to watch that stuff. Right, so to have the walkway come in on the front of those, so you can see it as opposed to on the back side of the buildings, seems to make a lot of sense. And there's been some interest in that as well, kind of doing that. So you could walk by, and because a lot of times when they're offloading fish and stuff, people will walk down there and like just stand in the middle of the driveway there, you know, and watch it. And so, be a delineated walkway that could go along there would be good. So,
I'm glad you on the item 8 on page 28, the Bay Shore Seafood. I'm glad you guys threw in that idea that I threw out last time about maybe having from a viewing platform. And again, I think I was going to ask you the status on roses, because I remember seeing the plans that they brought to planning and then to the council had some sort of an upper level deck mm-hmm. out there on the front. So that would be really nice. And do you know the status of where they're at?
I was at the Coastal Commission meeting in Port Hueneme last week, attending the meeting where it was approved.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So it's approved. So they'll be coming back through us for their precise plan approval and then to building.
So in that situation, when we can't do a floating dock because the boats come right up and dock there. That'll just be a missing link. In other words, when our signage, it won't really, we'll have continuity, we'll have visual access, let's say, but there won't be any, you won't never be able to walk around back there. Is that correct?
Not with that type of use there.
No.
I mean, that's the input we've been hearing so far. Not,
and they're
we
to
haven't taken
they go
this
to
all
2032, so that's almost the end of our general plan. So,
okay. Right.
Correct. So you're in some places you're not going to be able to achieve that in the near term. When lease sites redevelop like that, though, we'd probably be looking, if they wanted to maintain that use and redevelop it, we'd probably be looking at other alternatives to get it through there, maybe changes to the building design or whatnot that gets you out of the area where they're working. Again, and runs it maybe still on the bay side, so you're looking out at the water, but away from where they're unloading things constantly, because that's not really safe to have folks right in the middle of it. And so they'd have to redesign their building or something along those lines to get the investment. So there's ways to make it happen, you know, and still accommodate having the fishing industry use there. So.
Yeah. Well, their primary fish is slime eels, so I don't think anybody would want to get too close.
So in your report, it says that we have 96% accessibility of our shoreline, coastline here in Morro Bay, which seems pretty phenomenal to me. How does that compare to other communities? And is Coastal asking us for 100%? I mean, what? That's kind
that's
of
a good
huge.
Question. We haven't discussed this with Coastal yet. That's going to be the next step. I haven't seen statistics on that. I think we've all heard about places like Malibu where it's not very good at all. Yeah.
There are a lot of areas along the coast where there are, especially in Southern California, where they've seawalled things in and beaches are shrinking, and so access along the beach in front of homes doesn't exist other than at really low tides. There's several areas like that. Also in Northern California, that issue is there. So there are certainly communities, and I would get the more you go south, the less access there probably is, given the density of development down there. Certainly, we're probably better than a lot of those folks, but compared to others, I've not seen any sort of statistics related to that. This was an attempt at us solving issues that we saw that we had, and that Coastal, they regularly comment on how good our access to the beach is. Like, you don't have an issue of access, you know, but they recognize even in the access that we have that there are improvements that can be made and to make it clearer that where the public access is and those types of things, and that's why this is part of the thing that got us our grant, was this is one of the things they wanted us to do, is do the public access piece to dial that in, because they saw the same things that we saw when they came into town that could be done better and was a little unclear sometimes, and that way they didn't have to do all of this through conditioning. You know, it's all these, you know, one-off conditioning for projects whenever they saw it. It ends up with one-off looking solutions that are a little funky. Maybe if we could tell the story a little better up front, then it's not quite as funky, the access part.
We did, to follow on a little bit, we did look for existing regulations in other communities, and we included two of them, and we didn't find a ton. So I think that's the other piece, is actually, like Scott said, getting this codified a little bit more so it's not as cumbersome every time you review a project.
Scott, I had asked you this question a while back, and I don't remember if it was at a meeting or an aside, but you were going to check on the lease for the Blue Sky, because I see a discussion on that.
Yeah.
Can you know exactly what I'm talking
about?
I'm not trying to pick on them. I'm just trying to understand.
You did ask the question. We did do the research, and that seating area out there that breaks up the pathway that runs through there with the windscreen on it is approved that way. They are approved to have tables in certain areas on the building side of the walkway. Also along there. So most of the stuff out there we thought was pretty compliant. The plan had tables on one side and on the other, and so it was mostly compliant, I think. I think Cindy Jacinth, who's usually here, she had something going on tonight, but she was the one that did the research on it and took a look at it. We actually just talked about this maybe last week. So
the floating, the vacant lot the number 20 in that table. I'm just wondering, it seems like a vacant lot. People could just walk on it. I mean, so what do you need a floating access? I mean, if there's something there that's in the way, you might need a floating access. Is it only because, I don't know, is it to tie into the yacht club or to tie, or where, I mean, depending on where that thing is, or the house, I guess the two leases, the houses that have no access, I guess, and are stuck there till 2025. I'm just wondering why you need some special thing for a vacant lot.
That's a good point. Yeah, it was to have continuity with the other two lease sites just north of there, rather than have a floating that then transitions to land. And I guess this isn't something we discussed in terms of the vacant lot, but what the city's kind of perspective is on putting things on vacant sites that may get leased. I don't know what the thought is. It's also at the end, so it's kind of unique.
Yeah.
True. I mean, so the solution about putting the docks out there is to connect it to the other docks that are down there. And any new docks that come in are required to be available to the public.
Right.
So that sort of started, literally, that policy came about as part of the trifecta that was the GAFCO, Morro Bay Landing, Harbor Hut project that was approved over 10 years ago. And still isn't complete. But that the lateral access in that location ended up not being up at the level of the parking lot. It ended up being on the docks. That was a solution. And interesting how they got approved that way through the city and then also through Coastal Commission, but it did. And then from that point forward, they pushed that condition out onto every new dock that was built that it had to be available to the public. So it works for that. As far as what's going to happen with lease site 20, it's pretty small.
Well, that was my other question, too, is maybe is it too small to have other... I mean, it's like right on top of the sidewalk, so I didn't really know...
It's not... Yeah, it's not deep.
It's right... There's, you see those... It's those private... Those two little houses there, those little private houses, it's right in between that and, like, Tidelands, right?
It's
right...
It literally, yeah, it's right...
It's this little tiny place, yeah. Okay, I didn't even know that was a lot.
It's small. It's not... I mean, literally, we had the hotel across the street look at it and thought, oh, maybe it's really small, so maybe it's big enough that we could use it for a gathering and seating place, you know, for something, you know, related to their hotel at one point. And that was a conversation that we had. And that was probably the only inquiry that we've had on that piece of property since I started working here. So, and that didn't really go anywhere. Now they no longer own the hotel, so.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I would think a lot of people aren't even aware that it's a lot.
Probably not.
Okay, all right, because it's kind of a nice place for one.
Yeah.
If you, you know, for a small thing. Okay.
So, Scott, on the coastal access, we're talking like at these places and like at Blue Sky Bistro. You have access, but you said the tables were between... You're saying that the table should be closer to the building and the access should be on the beach side. Or like even down at Tidelands Park, do you have to have docks along there if you have the path that goes on the park? Do you have to have access right next to the water, or can it be up on a...
Well, so
where
so
you can see the water.
Where we get the access is when lease sites we develop. And so we have lease sites that are on land and we have lease sites that are in the water. Our waterfront master plan requires when you bring forward your development, it requires lateral access. In that document, the lateral access only has to be 8 feet wide, but Coastal Commission requires 10, so it's going to be 10 moving forward. And then on the waterfront, it's just if somebody wants to build docks there, they can. They can acquire that lease. They can lease it from the city. They'll be the leaseholder, and then they can rent those slips out to whomever they want at market rate. And so, and then those slips end up having to, or those docks end up having to be available to public. So you can have, moving forward, you will have, like, say, for the example that I gave earlier, the Off the Hook and Libertine. As those come forward, they're going to have both landside lease improvements that are going to have lateral access up at the street level, and then they're going to have lateral access or public access down onto their slips and our docks.
So access is not just being next to the water; it's being where you can touch the water.
Coastal Commission, as part of the discretionary permitting process, has required for several years now, and again, the City of Morro Bay was the lead on this, the GAFCO project, and now they require it for all new docks up and down the coast. It's not just for Morro Bay, but it's for everyone. They require them to be available to the public from dawn to dusk. So
to be able to touch the
touch the water, not just walk next to it, is what I'm saying. Cause
yeah, it seems like some of the walk is just, it's elevated. You can't,
yeah.
can't touch the water.
But I was thinking like at the Blue Sky Bistro, you walk, you said they're permitted to be the way they are, but to me, I don't see a problem with them having their tables where they do, because if you walk, you can get behind that building easily enough, and you can see the water there. So is it important for the tables to be next to the building and the public to be closer to the water? They have it the opposite way, but you still have access to see the bay.
You still have access. I would say the preferred alignment for things like that would not be the way that was designed. I would not advocate putting that windscreen seating area there because it breaks up the view corridor. As you're looking down the lateral access, you have something that's in the way of it. And so when you walk behind that building on the north side of it and look south and see that there, you're like, well, is this a public walkway? I'm not sure. You know, and that's what we don't want. We want it to look like it's public, and we want it to be very clear that it's public. And those types of improvements impede that because it makes it feel like you're not supposed to be there. And it shouldn't do that. And we shouldn't be approving things out there that do that, my opinion.
And then again, in Tidelands Park, when you're walking along the pathway or the sidewalk up by the park, that's the access, right? Do you still have to have a dock down below, a floating dock below?
I see what you're getting at. No, that would just be the access that runs along that thing. That's fine. There's not a required access there. The only requirement comes along when you're developing lease sites, whether that's on the water or on the land side. And sometimes the land side person that leases the land side portion isn't the same as the person that leases the water side, so they're different. It's not always the same. Usually it is, but it's not always.
And Scott, I endorse what you just said entirely. You know, with respect to tables and chairs, what should not be controlling is whether the tables and chairs are on private property or how many inches away from the border of the public access they are, but one of perception, and the test should be reasonable perception. Does a person visiting Morro Bay for the first time perceive that what he's looking at is public access, or is he in any way intimidated by stopping there for a moment and standing in front of diners and the like? That should be the test.
Mm-hmm. And I think Roses is going to be fixing theirs if they're close to their design, but that's actually even today is even worse than Blue Sky, as far as it absolutely begs you to look at it and go, oh, that's, I can't walk there.
Absolutely the case. I agree 100% with that. It's that enclosed walkway you walk through there. It doesn't look like you should ever be there. And at the end, you see tables. You're like, whoa. But the improvements, you know, that were approved along with that do dramatically improve the public access. They're connected out to the little pier thing that sits out at the end of the street end. Mm-hmm. That sits between that property and the Libertine. And then widens it out to the full 10 feet, removes the roof, so it'll look much more like you're supposed to be there, and then have signage that works accordingly. So.
And kudos to Dr. Teff, who no longer with us, but every day he took his dogs and walked through there to let people know that it was okay to walk there.
Yeah.
I would give kudos to lots of the dog walkers along the Embarcadero. They're definitely paving the way for a lot of things. Just to follow on to, and this may be just because this is how I take in information, but another way to convey that message of this path, that this harbor walk that is accessible for most of the Embarcadero, is on a directory sign or some other place having this type of map that we have on the poster, and but probably focused in more like, you know, you are here, and then they have the segment that you're in, and it shows the whole thing. So maybe when you're standing in front of the restaurant, you're not as sure, but if you are somebody who looks at the map, you would say, oh, yeah, I can go there. That's connected all along that section. So having that redundancy or different types of information rather than just the signs right at the location, I think, might be helpful as well.
I think it's both. It's when, you know, if you show it goes all the way through and you show that there are restaurants or whatever there, it makes it clear you can walk through what looks like a restaurant or something like that, that you really can go all the way through. So I think it's really good to have both of those things. I like your idea of showing the whole thing, but also showing the different locations. It's a, well, it goes right through there, so you can go. And I think that's really, really good idea.
Oh, I like
by the
that.
Way, the, I mean, that could be the thing that's at the top of all the signs that you have out there. You're like, so it makes it very clear. I mean,
I don't know why we never really conveyed that to the South. It's interesting. I mean,
it's a nice observation that you had. Never occurred to me.
It'll be really helpful for all those businesses, too, that don't have access right off of the Embarcadero to have a nice open harbor walk that
it's
they're
marketing, too.
Yeah. Find
blue
us.
And, you know, speaking back to Blue Sky, but, you know, they do a great job of vocally telling you that it's, you know, they don't really jump on you and assume you're a customer. They're really good at deciphering and, you know, hi, how you doing? But, you know, and there's nothing wrong with having people greeting our tourists and saying, hey, how you doing? You know, I think that's great.
Okay, then I have a problem on the curiosity on the way something was written. On page 63, under item A, in item 1, the statement about halfway through the paragraph that says, just a statement of would result in a change in use, an increase of 10% or less. And I want to know what does 10%, why do you say 10% or less? Why don't you just say any improvement? In that first, in number one, halfway through, developments which require this access are defined as improvements which would result in a change in use, an increase of 10% or less.
You hadn't read it in great detail, but 10% of what? 10% of...
And I saw this same phrase a couple of other times. I can't remember where it was, but... So I'm thinking, first I thought it was a misprint, and then I'm thinking, well, maybe that's some planning term or something. 10% or less.
Change in use. Well, they have 10% of an existing structure, but that first 10% isn't even clear what it's 10% of.
10% or less.
But that's our existing policy.
Or less. Yeah,
but the phrase, 10% or less, why don't you just say...
I think it could use some work.
It's not written well, I would agree with you. it also is our existing policies that we have, so yeah. What we're changing with this specific document, but yes.
We are including some of the existing with revisions, some of the existing have been included without revisions, and then some new policies and implementation actions in the draft plan. So we're definitely looking for this type of input.
Yeah, thank you.
To clean things up more. If we keep it in there for some reason, we'll come back and explain why. But it seems wonky to me.
Yeah, I agree. It doesn't. When you asked me about it, I looked at it. I had to read it 3 times, and I was like, "That's horrible."
And then the other thing, back on page 46, you're talking about the earthquake faults in this area, and the ones in the Morro Bay area. But there is, and so the last paragraph that begins with San Andreas Fault, down toward the next to the last sentence, it says the Hoskrie Fault, located approximately 33 miles south of downtown Morro Bay. And then in the next paragraph, it talks about the Hoskrie Fault, centered approximately 7.5 miles northwest of Morro Rock. So does that fault run, loop around? Or are those two faults? Because you talked about page 46. That's just a little curiosity thing. It caught my attention. I thought, whoa, what?
Well, it seems to me that the fault runs all the way through.
Because I think it's saying that particular earthquake occurred by Morro Rock, but it could be clarified.
The reason why I've noticed it, because up in the first paragraph under seismic conditions, it says the closest faults are Los Osos, Hoskrie, and Oceanic West Huasna, and Rinconanda. And then down later it only mentions those. That one fault is listed in two places, and that's why it was.
So I think we'll definitely check that, but I think saying that the fault is located 33 miles south, that may need to be reworded, because faults run, like Susan Schneider said,
yeah, I know they
for quite a distance.
Right.
So
I think what it's trying to suggest that if the temblor were to occur on that portion of it that's down 33 miles south, whatever, that you would have certain kinds of reactions in our town, whereas if it occurred on the northern portion of the fault, you would have others.
I understand
but
that perfectly.
I agree.
Yeah.
But if it's located 33 miles south of downtown, how could you have action on it 7.5 miles
northwest? I think Susan Stewart's right that it's actually an actual seismic event happening in that location, not the fault being only in that location.
But that's where the fault starts.
It sounds like it's confusing, so we'll
it could be
we'll
it could be clarified.
It.
Yeah, certainly.
Sorry.
On page
no,
six,
we like nitpicking because
it
back
you
get the range of comments.
Back to page 63. I had a couple things I had noted. Just that paragraph that Jan was just talking about, and it talks about. I'm sorry. Bullet point number two after that, it talks about the infeasibility, topical or site constraints. I think it's a typo because then in three, if continuous lateral access is found to be feasible due to the topical or site constraints, shouldn't that be infeasible too, or am I reading that wrong?
No, you're right. I think you're right.
Actually, under number two, that's actually phrased weirdly, too, because it talks
is.
About you have to provide the access unless the applicant can demonstrate that it's physically infeasible and there are no design alternatives that jeopardize, that would not jeopardize public safety, I think.
So I think number two is kind of establishing the fact that it might be infeasible.
Right.
And then if it is found to be infeasible, then there's an in lieu fee required.
But the word
number three?
In three it says feasible instead of infeasible.
You're right.
Yeah.
I think that's also reversed in number two. Because you have to, it should say you have to demonstrate that there are no design alternatives that would not jeopardize public safety. Otherwise you would have to do an alternative. So I think it's a little odd there too.
Need some help.
Kind of reversed.
Yeah.
Okay.
And do we have a program, a fee in lieu program, where the monies go into a fund, or is it all dumped into the general fund? Sorry, Scott.
I've not seen through our budgeting process any specific fund that relates to this. So I would say that we have the ability to collect the money based on the policy, but that perhaps the city's not done that. But I wouldn't 100% state that's the case. Because I haven't seen it doesn't mean it hasn't happened or doesn't exist. I've just it's not something that's come across, you know, my desk. It could be something that's located in a different department's budget, like, say, Public Works or something. Or it would be Harbor's, I guess, maybe.
A lease that is infeasible hasn't come up.
Well,
recently.
I think it sounds like we have had some, for example, for safety reasons where it's not feasible, and yet they don't have to pay an in lieu fee, but here it says they should, I think.
I'm just not sure how recently one that's, like, completely infeasible has happened. Anyway,
yeah, I'd have to do research to find out what the answer to that question is. I just don't know. I've just not seen any evidence of it, but it doesn't mean it didn't happen.
So it needs to be clarified or fixed, then,
It seems to me that environmental issues trump access issues, right? So if we're looking at something that's really going to harm eelgrass comes first before access. And there are certain things you can do, maybe like with that metal walkway to mitigate that. But say there was some situation where you really couldn't do anything to make access because of some environmental issue. Then we would be charging that business owner an in-lieu fee because of something that's basically took God.
I think we could.
I mean,
yeah.
Really?
I think,
wow.
I think that could.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And one last thing on that same page while we're there, further down on item 5A, open and closed walkways, a minimum of 8 feet wide across the base side of the proposed development. Why does that go down from our requirement of 10 down to 8?
That's what I was referring to before, is the current policy has it at 8 because it's old, and the Coastal Commission has since said, no, it needs to be 10, and so all projects that are down there are 10, and that's the information that we convey to the applicants when they come forward. And we do get to see them early on, so it's not like they've designed something ahead of time. We talk to them up front. Mm-hmm. Most of them know, but, you know, and let them know that it has to be 10, and so that's one of the things we'll be updating as part of the
Okay,
of
so
process.
This will change. Okay.
Yeah.
I got a question about Giovanni's site. I think on page 30, there's you've got the leaseholds in purple, and if I can read this right, it looks like Giovanni's is one of the leaseholds with two owned
30?
Parcels to the east of it. But then on the
you're talking about page 28, maybe?
Let me go look. It might be.
Yeah, 27.
What's the figure number?
Number 2.
Well, it's not what I'm this getting.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's actually page number 5 in your document. Yeah, in the document. I'm sorry. I'm looking at the PDF here. I'm getting different numbers.
All right.
On that map on page 5, it looks like if I'm reading this right, there's a purple area here where Giovanni's is. And I'd always understood that that was privately owned. In table 1, you refer to it as not a lease site. So this map is the one.
So figure 2 in the legend, I think we're going to change that to be something more broad than waterfront leases and just say that it's the lateral access focus area. You're correct that there are several parts of the Giovanni's stacks area that are not lease sites. So they are they have different ownership. Okay. And that is shown correctly, I believe, on the 3 series figures. We do have some edits that we were given by Harbor Department that we weren't able to get into this version to clean up a couple things related to the lease site designations, but that's my general understanding for that particular one.
That's correct, and it picks up a couple of these things, the comments that we've got back from Harbor on it.
Scott?
With respect to design guidelines, references to
I would be very much in favor of omitting any reference to nautical motifs, because I think that's construed as absolutely we don't want the flotation life things and the ropes wrapped around bollards.
We could change it to authentic as opposed to that, which sounds fairly cheesy. But this is consistent with recent, you know, adoption of the Downtown and Waterfront Strategic Plan. We need to be consistent with our documents, so we need to have and that was what came out of the public outreach process that we did for that. So it needs to reflect that. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we're making a 180-degree change from a document we just adopted by council, you know, a month ago. But I would say I agree with what you're saying. And I think everybody, when we went through the process, said that's fine, but not the cheesy type stuff. You know, it needs to be authentic was what went along with that. And that's even the commentary that I mean, we've heard a lot of it actually from Planning Commissioner Chair Luer. Was very much like that's fine, but not the over the top kind of cheesy portion of it. It needs to be authentic to what's here, and so and I think even Planning Commissioner Lucas picked that up as well. So
you want the historic character of the fishing village?
Yes.
I'm going to apologize for being maybe unsophisticated, but how is that not nautical?
The point is it will be nautical, but we want the authentic nautical, and I think much too frequently a nautical is anything but that.
Yeah. So it sometimes can be, yes. And so, but that's the commentary that we had going through that original process and public outreach, that's what they wanted, and that was actually even part of the economic development strategic plan that we did, and the outreach for that said the same thing. But everyone had the same concern that you do, and that's that it needs to be authentic and not phony.
And related to that is what they mentioned in the memo about adding such things as newsstands and kiosks and drinking fountains. the same thing. You know, the public should have access to the beauty of the bay, but we don't want to make it clutter or even make it significantly more convenient. We're not in the business of making access convenient. We want to make it accessible, and we don't want to clutter what we're trying to give access to and preserve. So I would be very careful about that. We're not in the business of making it so easy that everyone can come and see it. We have to be reasonable about this.
Go ahead.
I'm just curious to know how the Coastal Commission would respond to that.
I'm not sure I would even agree with that. Why would you not want it to be accessible to everyone? Maybe I'm misinterpreting what you're saying.
I'm not saying it, of course, should be accessible to everyone.
Or not easily accessible to everyone.
But I don't believe the definition of that is we should have periodic water fountains, we should have periodic kiosks, we should have newsstand devices. I don't see where, and I'm not making this up, I read that in the memo, so mm-hmm. I don't see where that's required. It should be there at all.
I do remember newsstands coming up a few years back as a big issue, that they were a real cluttered appearance with all these racks of newspaper things and the little metal boxes, and that they, okay, well, let's put them on the land side, not the water side. And I'm a big believer, though, in public restrooms. I'm a big believer in drinking fountains. I think as we move forward and we start seeing the limitations of, say, plastic drinking bottles being allowed to be available, like our new airport has bottle refill stations. And I think that kind of thing, we really need to start addressing that. I don't know if we need public telephones. We might. When was the last time you saw a phone box that wasn't broken or something?
At all.
Yeah. So I kind of get what you're saying. You don't want to clutter up this walkway area. I do like, given the nature of what we're trying to expose people to, the informational signage. We have some. A lot of it's getting faded, I was noticing. I think that stuff is good. So I guess I'm sort of in between. You know, bicycle racks, do we need that? Somewhere you've got to have, mm-hmm. you know, maybe every few blocks, but do you need one every block?
We even talked about at the council meeting on Tuesday. This is one of the items that was before with the council was the Adopt a Thing mm-hmm. program, and then they went into the street furniture and those types of things. And one of the items that wasn't clearly brought up during that conversation, but was one that I broached with the Public Works Director this morning, was to pay attention to the conversations related to that, the street furniture discussions that took place in the Economic Development Strategic Plan and Downtown and Waterfront Strategic Plan. And you might have heard them say, oh, the benches that we might want to do are the same everywhere, are the same ones that we have out by the rock. And I don't think the council received that very well. And I wasn't surprised. I was like, I don't know that we really want those everywhere. I don't think they're appropriate really along the waterfront in the Embarcadero area nor in the downtown. Going to be looking at that as far as that planning effort goes, and having something that's a little more eclectic and a little more interesting for those two areas and maybe distinct to those, and probably going to dovetail that into the implementation efforts that we're doing with the chamber for the Economic Development Strategic Plan and Downtown Waterfront Strategic Plan. So anyway, just sort of a note there that we are going to be looking at some of those things.
I do like the idea of benches and things that people can look, but like Joe is saying too, I don't think we need to clutter with mm-hmm. too many signs. The Embarcadero is not that long of a space, and if you put signs like every block or every other block, you'd be at the
kiosk.
Yeah, the kiosk and too many and way too many of these wayfinding stations and stuff.
So the idea behind this and
cluttering.
The thing that it could achieve, one of the issues that we have problems with the signage on the lease sites. And it's sign creep, and they end up with a whole bunch of signs out there, and there are a whole bunch of small signs. And if you looked, you stand on the sidewalk and look down the Embarcadero, you see all of these things. When you walk along, you don't see them because they're small signs and they're illegible, and they don't really serve the function that the people thought they served when they put them out there. Some of them are handwritten. I mean, they don't look good. No one looks at them because it's just background chatter, you know, noise. A lot of times these things get put forward by some of those businesses that are on the backside that think, well, no one can see me. And so some of these directional kiosk type things could serve dual function and have who's on the back of the building and those types of things, so we'd stop getting some of those things. And then you have to combine that with our sign program where we need to go through and clean up those things as well to remove some of the clutter, because that is a problem down there. It is something I notice whenever I go down there. And I think I'm glad we're working towards it. It'll be great when we're done, but I mean, I absolutely see what you're saying.
I wonder how much of that will be alleviated when we get our sidewalks widened. So, I mean, some of the clutter is when you're in this little confined mm-hmm. space mm-hmm. and you've got light poles and, you know, newspaper yeah. boxes, and there's just too much. But if you have that yeah. sort of feeling of openness. I also think as much as we don't want to Disney-fy Morro Bay, and we also have to recognize that we are very dependent on visitors and tourists and people who've never been here before. And yes, the town is for all of us who live here, but we also can't sustain ourselves as a city without those people. So we have to be able to make things understandable and accessible and point them where we want them to go. You know, I think all the benches and seating is a good idea, but I think we also kudos to our restaurants who are willing to put tables and chairs and things out to give people a place to stop and sit, too. So it's a challenge, you know, but we got to pay the bills. And part of paying the bills is making it look good, make it accessible, hopefully keep that character, but we can't hide it.
So. Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a difference between looking like Disneyland and looking like No Man's Land, you know. And so I think you have to help people. You have to show them where things are. I think you have to make, I mean, restrooms, given the demographic of Morro Bay, even the people who live here, you need restrooms. You got people in those demographics that need access to those things. And people who come here with children or whatever, you have to have those things. I think restaurants sometimes, I have my concerns along, say, Morro Bay Boulevard, where people are actually blocking access, or, you know, a couple of places on Main Street where you can't get through because people's dogs are laying in them across the sidewalk because they're sitting at a table. I'm just saying. So I think there's a happy medium somewhere where you just have to help people get places, and it should be easy and convenient, but it should, of course, it shouldn't be cluttered. It certainly should not detract from the natural beauty along the waterfront. So I think there's a fine line there, and I think it's almost a judgment call as you look at the individual issues.
So back on the sign discussion, are you aware, the way I understand it from one of the places that I perform at, the area where Blue Sky and Windows in the Water, those buildings, they have their own restrictions on what signs are allowed. Now, if that's true, that seems like that's going to be a potential conflict as we move to signage that's looking kind of, you know, the same.
Well, each lease site has, I think I mentioned this earlier, each lease site has a requirement when they come through to do development that they have their sign program dialed in. And so every lease site has its own sign program. In fact, I was talking to one of the planners today about looking up what the sign program was on one of the lease sites to make sure that it was consistent, because an issue came up. It's something that we talk about frequently, and we look at now as sign applications. The lease site was actually the Dutchman today. They wanted to do some new signage. We're like, okay, great. You know, I told the planners, make sure you pull the sign program out and take a look at it, because I know there's signage on there that's not on there. and so we had to talk to them and say, well, we need to, all of your new signage now that's out here needs to be on here, and we need to look at it to see if it's, you know, consistent with our code and that type of thing. And so it's that way for each project has its own sign program. It's not that you can't change it. You can. And this is an instance where the Dutchman's going to come forward and want to add some additional signage, maybe remove some, and they're going to change their sign program, and we'll be amending that. So
that's correct, then. Each lease site can have their own signage rules.
They kind of do within the overall overarching parameter of not only the CDP that's issued, but also the
right.
city sign ordinance.
Okay.
It's both
okay.
things, because you have the directional and required signage by the Postal Commission for public access, and then you have our regular sign requirements for, say, the Dutchman, and that type of thing. So.
Okay, and then on page 37, public safety, the lighting talks about, which is really accurate, it talks about as the stores start shutting down, the water side of the Embarcadero gets darker and darker. Could we consider putting in language that's suggesting solar, promoting solar lighting along that for the lighting? That would be, I think, a good idea.
So when you say solar lighting, do you mean like a light that looks like a regular electric or other type of light, but is solar, or something?
Well, that would be the other question. Does it need to have design criteria, or can it be what's out there on the market for decent solar lighting? I'm not talking about a dollar store, little dollar, deal, but something that's decent, and they work quite well anymore.
Mm-hmm. I was checking because I wasn't sure if there was something I didn't know about that was different from looking like conventional lighting, because I'm not an expert on solar lighting, but I don't see why that wouldn't be something to consider. It's part of the vision and policy for the city to be more energy efficient.
Yeah.
And just to clarify to you, Scott, when I was earlier brought up about needing more work on from code on the lease sites, I wasn't implying that. I realize that you take your direction from council as far as where you put the code resources. I'm just suggesting if, it's our bread and butter, like Susan was talking about, that maybe bring it to council's attention that needs a little bit more walking.
I don't disagree with you.
Yeah.
And the council's given us some direction to that end. And there's been commentary at the Planning Commission related to the sign ordinance and things like that about when we look at cleaning these things up and how we go about doing that. I would imagine we're going to have some more direct enforcement once we're done with this overall process. And, the council was specific in talking with the harbor director about what their expectations are in reviewing leases and doing that and going through that process and making sure they stay compliant, because it's not something we've kept up on in the past. Our code enforcement folks right now work part-time, and we had, I think, through the first three quarters of this year, this fiscal year, ending February anyway, 249 code enforcement investigations.
Wow.
Yeah, they're busy. So there's quite a bit. So there's a lot there, and there's a capacity issue to some extent about that. So I was surprised that we had that many. When I saw the number, I just got the report on it for budget purposes about the beginning of the week, I think, Monday or Tuesday. So.
Page 66, and it's part of the existing Morro Bay General Plan. Parking shall be provided in conjunction with new or improved vertical access ways whenever feasible and consistent with the site constraints to ensure use of the access way. Do we really want that in there? Uh-huh, page 66B2. Vertical access requirements, parking. It seems like one of the things we don't want to do is put more parking places. We want people to be walking along these access ways. And if you, I don't know where you put more parking.
Yeah, I guess, first of all, it says when feasible and consistent with the site constraints. I'm not sure if this is something Coastal wanted to have in there when this was put into the
It's standard language for vertical access that you will see in many LCPs that are old like ours.
Okay.
And so it just means vertical access in general and along the entire coast in the city of Morro Bay. So the idea is if you're going to have vertical access somewhere, say in the north end of town, mm-hmm. it'd be great if you could provide some parking in that location. It's fairly vague, and I've seen the same language in numerous LCPs.
Okay.
When I was in PISMA.
You've got a question of access to the lateral access,
right.
If that makes sense.
So you could say you can park out at the Rock and walk all the way into all of our lateral
if you're actually
access.
Able to do that. Yeah. But for people who are not able to do that, it would be good to have some other way to get there.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the keys in that section, and when it says number of spaces shall be determined by the director who shall consider the carrying capacity of the public recreation area. So that's...
Well, and
that's a broad statement.
And I would say arguably in the location that we're talking about for the purposes of this document, it's inappropriate to do this. We don't want more parking in those locations. In fact, the street ends are an inappropriate use, in my opinion, of that space. It should be something else. We shouldn't dedicate it to cars. The congestion that you have down there, removing some of the cars out of it, would make a nicer pedestrian experience and a nicer visitor experience. And those are the conversations that we've had with the public to this point, which support that.
Well, I think you're talking about maybe parking or other ways of access. I think you want access, not necessarily parking per se.
And again, this is for citywide policy, so maybe more appropriate in areas on the north side of town versus in the middle of the Barcadero.
Has there been any discussion to extend the trolleys or allow a for-profit to come in with an alternatives like pedicabs, horse-drawn. When you're talking about the flavor of and the harbor walk, you know, calling it all the harbor walk, and they have some of those options.
The answer is yes. This time of year, every year since I've been here, we get about 3 or 4 inquiries from folks that want to operate pedicabs, and we're working through that with some of them. The problem is there's a permitting fee that goes along with it, even to establish a temporary use permit. It's in the tune of about $1,000, because that's about how much it costs us to process the permit and get input from all of the departments that need to have input, which is Public Works and the Police Department and the Harbor Department. So it ends up being a barrier, and that's me being creative, getting it down to $1,000. You know, and on an ongoing long-term basis, it should be probably a conditional use permit type process, which is more in the $6,000+ range. And the use and how does it pay for itself, which is why I got it down to $1,000, but was still, you know, seems to be an impediment to some of them. And so need to have some internal conversations about how to get around that, because it seems like an interesting idea and one that we'd be interested in having, or at least testing out. What was the other part of the question? I'm sorry.
No, that was it. Pedicabs or horses.
More uses of the shuttle service, that right?
Right.
Increased
right.
use. And they are talking about that right now, I believe. It's not something I'm typically too involved in, but I believe they're having that conversation right now.
Okay. And I realize that we're smaller, but you know, down in San Diego, Seaport Village area, all through there, is well-received, the pedicabs, and well-used. Of course, you have the nightlife districts and stuff that they've redone, but the gas lamp district,
that's the
word I was trying to think of. But it would seem like we would have some use, even if it... Maybe looking at it opposite of the trolley so that it wouldn't conflict, and then provide alternative uses during the time when the trolley is down to have somebody do that.
It's a different experience. I think it's probably okay to have both. It's just, you know, as we've tried to work through it, there's still a cost to process these types of things, and so they haven't been willing to invest the money to go through it. We've gotten them to a point. I mean, like, I've gotten some business plans from them and some maps about how they would function. I was like, oh, this all looks great, and then we get to talking about cost, and we haven't gotten an actual application to come forward, so it's an issue there.
I think that when Todd's was out offering those Sedgway tours or something, apparently that must not have gone over well, since they are not doing it anymore. But
he wasn't always open, for one thing. And another thing, you know, Rich, there is right now, speaking of the trolley and stuff, there is a survey that's being taken right now on the city website about your uses of the public transportation. Whether you use it or not, they want you to fill it out, and so maybe that would lead to some of the things you want.
Yeah.
Do
So yeah, they are requesting, if you think that there's a need for additional bus or trolley services in various areas, that you weigh in on the survey. So I mean, that is one of the things we are looking at currently. That's correct.
So we have about 5 minutes just to give everybody a time check.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments? Closing comments from committee members?
One last question, a brief one. The cyclone fence that's peeled back at the north end of town that was referenced in the memo. What's the story on that? Is the fence pulled back in some now legal status, or did somebody just improvise and the fence is supposed to go back, or why? Just curious about that.
I thought they were talking about the fence north of North Point. That's along the the highway there.
This along the Caltrans right of way.
Yeah, and where people park, where they're not supposed to park, or just they've made up their own parking lots there, and they get through the fence to the beach there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So is that
Dog Beach is not in the city. It's in our sphere of influence.
Right.
But it's not in the city.
But the fence was referenced in this material. And so I'm glad you asked that, because I was wondering the same thing. If that's against Coastal Commission desires, doesn't Caltrans have to take that down, or is that under Caltrans' responsibility to do something with it?
What it's describing here is that the informal access points have been created, so I'm not sure that it's calling for taking it down.
No, but it mentioned that it was not... didn't have a, I can't remember the word, but it wasn't a very complimentary word about the fence being there. And so it was like seemed like it was violating the access that Coastal Commission wants us to have.
It's definitely noting where there's that type of encroachment and making it harder to access. So
couldn't Caltrans be gently suggested to take it down?
The Coastal Commission knows it's there, so I don't know. I mean, and that thought fencing's been there for a very long time.
Seems like it's been informally mitigated.
So I'm not really sure with how it got there and what the permitting process was or any of those types of things.
Somebody does.
Okay. Any other closing comments from the committee? How about from our community development director, or Michael Baker, or both?
At this point, I don't think I have anything. I mean, I think we're going to be bringing. We're looking at the model zoning next
time. That's my understanding.
Yeah.
We'll check in with Martha next week on that.
If I can actually get my comments.
Get my comments back into her. We might be having that, so that might be an interesting conversation, because it's going to have a lot of the use regulations in there, and you'll get to see the new what those new zoning code classifications will be, which will be interesting. So that's probably what's going to be coming to you next time.
And we won't be seeing our draft plan for a while, probably.
Given the comments that we have on the document currently, and the fact that we need to get some additional comments back on three documents they haven't commented on, probably not.
Okay.
We were thinking it might have been April, I think, but initially. Okay. But I think we're probably looking at May. Wouldn't you think where we're at now?
I would guess so. Yeah.
Okay. All right, I think we are ready to adjourn. Our next meeting is April 19th here at the Vets Hall at 4 p.m. Thank you. Are you?
I'm always a little chilly in here.
I'm always too warm, so it works for me.